Hey, compost lovers. In July, I went on a two-day compost tour around Vermont with my farm's compost production manager, Justin Boss. The drive is about 6 hours, getting more and more breathtaking the farther you go, past the ocean state of Rhode Island, through Massachusetts, into New Hampshire, and finally into those iconic green Vermont mountains. We stopped at three incredible sites: Vermont Natural Ag Products, where Mudu is made, Vermont Compost Company, and Green Mountain Compost, which is part of the Chittenden Solid Waste District. Big thanks to Brian Jarosz from AgriLab Technologies for organizing the tour and joining us along the way. Today's episode comes from a walk and talk at Green Mountain Compost with Dan Goosen. Dan was super generous with his time. He gave us a full tour of the site and shared insights from over 20 years in the composting world. There's a lot to take away from this conversation, but one story in particular stands out: Dan's experience being the first compost operator in the country to publicly deal with persistent herbicide contamination. Back in 2012, before anyone really knew about these chemicals, Green Mountain Compost made national news when they discovered 10,000 cubic yards of compost had been affected. It all started with one customer calling about a garden that wasn't growing right, then came 500 more. You can imagine the heartbreak, putting your heart into making great compost, only to find out that an unknown herbicide in manure can ruin your whole batch. Dan's openness in sharing what happened has helped the whole industry move forward. It's a powerful story. Dan also shares awesome tips and enhancements on their site. There's a lot to learn here. Let's jump in. This episode is brought to you by AgriLab Technologies. Visit them at agrilabtech.com/podcast. And Compost Systems of Austria at compost-systems.com. Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for compost lovers. Host and fellow composter Jane Murner. Through real conversations with composters and industry professionals, we are digging deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production. Whether you're managing a large-scale site or just compost curious, this podcast is here to inform, inspire, and connect us all as part of a growing movement to enliven the world's soils. In 2023, I went with my son on a compost tour of Austria through the International Solid Waste Association. Maybe not your typical family vacation, but ideal for the two of us. I was impressed with the 30 years Austria has thoughtfully developed a whole nation compost system, which started with the 1992 ban on food scraps being landfilled. A steady voice in Austria's composting world is Aurel Lubka of Compost Systems of Austria. Like me, Aurel carries his father's legacy, restoring soil fertility through quality compost. With an engineer's mindset and a farmer's heart, he turned that passion into Compost Systems of Austria, now a proud sponsor of this podcast. Compost Systems of Austria is your engineering partner for state-of-the-art composting facilities, from small open sites to large enclosed plants and everything in between. With full odor control, they handle everything: process and facility design, odor and emission management, plastic removal, moisture control, logistics, optimization, and the most reliable compost turners on the market. Contact Compost Systems directly at compost-systems.com or through their North American partner, Green Mountain Technologies, at compostingtechnology.com. This summer, I visited Vermont Natural Ag Products, the home of Mudu Compost. One thing that really stood out was an innovative system from AgriLab Technologies that both speeds the compost process using aeration and captures thermal heat from the compost to warm the Mudu bagging barn. Ingenious. I reached out to Brian at AgriLab Technologies afterwards, and I'm thrilled to share that they now generously sponsor this podcast. AgriLab Technologies provides solutions for efficient composting. Their team works with farmers, commercial, institutional, and municipal composters to save energy, labor, and space on your site. Their modular compost aeration equipment and technical support services improves process control, making better compost faster with less odor and impact. They can also capture renewable thermal energy from composting to heat nearby buildings, wash water, and for drying finished compost. Build your soil and burn less oil. reach out to AgriLab Technologies today. Visit us at agrilabtech.com/podcast. Welcome to the Composter, Dan. I'm so happy to have you on. And thanks for giving me a walking tour, actually, of your place just a couple weeks ago. I learned so much from walking around it. And I'm wondering if you could share where you're located, how long you've been in business, and a quick tour in words of your site.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming. That was a lot of fun to see you guys around. Glad we got a good weather day. You never know in Vermont if that's going to be the case. So we are in Williston, Vermont, and that's part of Chittenden County, which is basically the population center for Vermont. Just for comparison of scale for other folks, we have less than 1 million people in the entire state. Something like half of the population, or actually I think more than half of the population maybe lives in our county. So Burlington is the kind of the population center. That's where the University of Vermont is. It's right on Lake Champlain on the western side of the state, northwestern part of the state. We've been at this location since 2011. We opened up here, and that was after about a quarter century within Burlington city limits at the Intervale, which is this amazing agricultural land that is within the city limits of Burlington. It's home to a dozen organic farms, and it was where Gardner Supply started. You know, Will Rapp was the person who started all that. The compost project was part of that whole evolution started by Gardner Supply employees back now 37 years ago. Anyway, so the compost project has been around for a long time. We've changed our name a couple of times. So our official current name is the Chittenden Solid Waste District Organics Recycling Facility, or WORF for short. But most people know us currently as Green Mountain Compost. So we are the biggest food waste composter in Vermont, which again is big for Vermont, isn't necessarily big for California or other places in the country, but we're pretty large. And maybe we're a medium-sized composter in the national context. So we take food waste or food scraps. I've been saying food waste for decades, and it's hard to get over that habit, but I'll have to try my best. So I'll try food scraps. We take food scraps primarily. They're the driver of our process, and we mix them with yard waste, which is what we call green waste here, and that is the majority, but we do use quite a bit of horse manure and bedding and some wood products. And we have an interesting setup where we do about 4 to 5 weeks of aerated static piles on the front end of the process. So we have an acre of concrete. A third of that is dedicated to our food waste receiving. I did it already. Food scrap receiving area and our initial aeration phase, which is just a couple of weeks. That's under cover. We have in-ground aeration troughs that also provide drainage. And we do highly controlled initial composting there. So we have digital temperature probes, and we can control the fans remotely. And after a couple of weeks, we pull out the material. We put it on our concrete pad, which has some drainage attached to it, which connects to an underground tank. So that's how we capture our leachate or high-strength liquid. And we typically add moisture both on the front end before it goes into aeration. And then after that initial aeration, we have to add more moisture to bring it back up to our target moisture content before we then aerate it for typically about 3 additional weeks. And then we're done with what according to our permit is our active compost stage. And at that point, this is something that we've changed a little bit in recent years, but we're actually screening right after that down to 2 inches. So we acquired a trommel screener with a pretty big drum on it that allows us to pull out anything over 2 inches. And it's at that point that we are actually doing a hybrid composting setup, and we switch to windrows. traditional compost windrows. And there it sits for an additional 2 on the short end, but probably more likely 3 to 4 months for full curing and maturation, during which time we're actively turning the piles with a windrow turner. At the end of that process, we screen it again. That becomes our final product, our final compost product is screened to about 3/8 of an inch. We use a star screener for that. At that point, it's been in composting process for maybe 5 to 6 months on average, which is considerably quicker. And that probably sounds slow to some folks, but it's a much quicker process than our old method, which was still a hybrid, but utilized a much longer curing time due to space constraints that required us to build our windrows very large.
I have that, those too. I have that kind of that space constraint. We have a longer process here.
Yeah. I hear that a lot from composters.
You're the only one I've talked to that does this, the second screen. So was that at 7 weeks, you said, that you do that second screen?
No, the screen, the final screening is, it's like months. So the initial screening is around 5 weeks.
Okay, 5 weeks.
Or 6 weeks. Yeah. And then we screen it again at the end of the process when we were convinced that it's fully mature and ready for sale.
Is that first screen more for inorganics, like the trash component, or more for larger wood chips, things like that?
Yes, it is for the non-compostable products that might be in the mix that we missed on our initial visual screening on the as materials received. So we can talk more about it, but we've implemented a lot of changes in the last number of years for contamination reduction, and that has been a big piece of that. And it's not without some costs. Obviously, running a screen every time you touch the compost, you're spending some money to do so. And they don't give away screeners these days, as you know. But we've really, so far, and we're always constantly iterating and changing our process a little bit and considering new ways to do it. But right now, it's working pretty well. We really like the ability to pull out the larger, significantly larger fractions early on. It still has wood components in there that are adding to porosity. And yet, if there was a plastic bag, some of our biggest issues with contaminants are film plastics. And we found it pretty effective at pulling those out in a large format. So a lot of composters will grind or shred on the front end, put all their food through one of those machines and get really good results in terms of rates of degradation and good homogenization perhaps on their mix. But if there's something that was inorganic and large at the early stages and you put it through something with that many teeth moving that quickly, you end up with a lot of pieces of whatever it was.
Harder to clean up.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to avoid. And we had great success. Prior to the implementation of that initial screener, we had a big problem with film plastic going from large pieces into small pieces and creating a nightmare.
Yep.
So it was.
You have that wind sifter on that first trommel.
We do. Yeah. We run a Dobstadt 720 trommel, and we got their Ecoverse's Aeris wind sifter to go with it. We've run different wind sifters in the past on different machines, and so far so good. It works really well. It doesn't get every piece, of course, because there's plastic that gets caught under a rock or a larger piece of wood coming out. But I think we're estimating, especially if we can get it on the first pass, that it gets something in the order of 90% probably of our film plastic out.
Yep.
If it doesn't get it out on the first pass and then we have concentrated plastic in our overs mix, then it's much, much trickier to get that kind of percentage. And so we're working on that. We have an older pile that's kind of built up over a couple of years before we made some of our most recent changes, and it's thick in there. The plastic is thick within, which is in a pile of almost all wood, but for anybody who's tried this, like pulling plastic, film plastic, especially out of wood that's maybe 3 to 4 or 5 inches in diameter, is really hard. So that's what we're working through. The last couple of weeks have had some awesome success getting through a big chunk of that pile. But yeah, the trommel and the Aeris wind sifter have been an awesome addition for just reducing the amount of plastic that gets to our windrows, which otherwise was getting chopped up when we hit it with a windrow turner.
Yeah. Something I had never seen before was your use of dump trucks to move your compost to those back area windrows. And that was really neat to see. I kind of want to see how that developed and a change for you guys. And also your blending process was really neat with windrow turners. I also hadn't seen a windrow turner used that way. So can you talk about those, how they came about and how things have evolved over time with those like little things like that, or big things really?
For sure. Yeah, those were both big changes to our facility. About 5 years ago, approximately, we got a small grant from the state of Vermont to improve our organics infrastructure. I forget what the official name of the grant was, but it allowed us to do an expansion of our curing area and improve the working surfaces on the far end of our facility where we do both the windrow curing, and then adjacent to that, we have another 3-acre pad or so where we do our final processing via the star screener and our final product blending. And as part of that project, we also acquired a windrow turner and the haul truck that we use. So it was a big, big change for us. And it was mostly driven by actually the recognition that adding a windrow turner would greatly increase our efficiencies on site. So prior to that, the process I described for the front end of the aeration was pretty similar, minus the trommel. And every 3 or 4 yard scoop was all moved in a front end loader with windrows formed, really tall windrows. And we were turning those with an excavator, which does a great job at gently aerating piles. Doesn't chew up plastic, for instance, but it took us forever to turn piles. So I owe a debt of gratitude to Craig Coker, who spent some time with us and pointed out something that in retrospect, perhaps were maybe obvious, but actually some novel ideas. I don't know how close you know Craig, but he's done a lot of work all over the country on compost facilities, but is also intimately involved with a couple where he lives in Virginia. And one of those, I think it's Red Oak Farm, something Oak Farm. They'd been using a windrow turner there for non-traditional applications for quite a few years. We talked to them and became convinced that that was the machine for us and it was going to save us a lot of time and money. And indeed, we basically replaced 5 pieces of heavy equipment with the arrival of our turner. So we have a Backus A55 windrow turner that's now about 5 years old. We use it for 3 processes on site. The first one is actually blending our incoming materials. So as the food scraps are dropped, they get bucket blended real roughly with the rest of the recipe. And then when we have enough to fill one of our aeration bays, we make a windrow and turn it with the windrow turner. I think we're currently at 4 passes with the windrow turner over this windrow, and it does an amazing job at homogenizing all the inputs. So even if you just like layer them lasagna style, it comes out looking like finished compost, basically. And it will break bags open, but the goal is to not do much more than that. So like not to shred up the plastic. So it does a pretty good job with that. And then the next use for it is windrow turning, which was, you know, most compost facilities use windrow turners for turning their curing compost. So we do that as well. And that stage, making that shift from excavator to windrow turner, allowed us to turn all of our curing material. It used to take us about 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks, to do one pass on all of our curing windrows. And we can now do that in 3 or 4 hours. So that alone was hugely beneficial in terms of the time save. And then we use it one more time to mix up a bunch of our value-added blends. So we currently are making 3 products, essentially. Our normal compost, which just is sold right out of the 3/8-inch screen. But then we utilize that screen compost to make a couple of soil products and a topsoil and a garden mix. And for that, we used to painstakingly bucket blend those recipes and then put them through a couple of different trommels to make our finished product. And again, I think this was Craig suggested, try doing it this way. And sure enough, you can make a really nice finished soil product using just a windrow turner. If your compost is small enough and clean enough to begin with, and your other inputs are mostly free of larger materials, it looks almost identical to our screen product that we used to put through a 1/2-inch screen, which would take so long to do, especially if the weather was unfavorable. Even a rainy day sometimes would throw it off. And So we can now make hundreds and hundreds of yards of material in half a day.
That's so great. You've convinced me.
Yeah.
I think we're going to try that for mixing our blends, because we've been doing it bucket by bucket, trying to mix 50 yard batches. And it's really tricky to get a homogeneous blend. So I watched that process when I was there, and I was like, oh, I think I'm sold on that.
Yep. So for that, we do 4 or 5 passes generally. And, you know, you can just look and feel kind of thing, but you can tell, like, one of our blends has some peat moss in it, and it becomes fully homogenized within 4 or 5 passes typically. So, yeah, again, Craig Coker wins the prize for that good idea. We really, really appreciate that. And then the haul truck. So it's basically a quarry truck that we're using now. Great deal on a used one with pretty high hours, but not super old. That came out of some major operation somewhere, some quarry operation. And we now utilize it once we are done on our front end. Our site is pretty spread out, start to finish. And so there's a lot of travel required to move material from one end to the other. And we used to do it again with a bucket loader, but we now are using the haul truck for moving it from basically the post right after that initial screening on our trommel. It then goes down to the windrow area, but it's, I forget the exact distance, but it's maybe a couple thousand feet. It's pretty far for a loader to do in small bucket increments. And Craig saw that. He said, yeah, anything more than, I'm going to get the number wrong, but maybe it was like 500 feet. And it might have been a little bit, maybe it was 500 yards. I can't remember, but whatever it was, he was like, yeah, you should really consider using a truck instead of a bucket because it's more efficient. And not only is it more efficient in terms of time, but the haul truck forms a perfect shaped and sized windrow for us. So it doesn't require an extra step of like following it up with a loader to push it up. And the best part probably is that we don't really spill anything from point A to point B. Whereas when you're moving material with a bucket, inevitably, having done it myself for thousands and thousands of cubic yards, you inevitably end up spilling a lot every time there's a bump or you're going around a corner a little quickly because you're trying to maximize how much you can fit in that bucket so that you can do less trips.
Yeah, your pad was nice and clean. There wasn't a lot of spilling, you could tell. You can tell those sites where
it hasn't always been that way.
Yeah. That becomes mud, you know, so that's...
Yeah. Really quickly it becomes mud, you know. So that was a huge benefit and another one that we're grateful for Craig for pointing out. There's the Craig Coker advertisement. That was not the intention, but we did benefit greatly from his services.
That's great. This episode is brought to you by AgriLab Technologies. Visit them at agrilabtech.com/podcast and Compost Systems of Austria at compost-systems.com. Hey, listeners, we are looking for sponsors to help pay for the Composter podcast. Do you have a tool, app, or gear that composters should know about? This is a very targeted audience of composters and farmers around the world that want to know about what will make our compost businesses better. Advertise with us by emailing info@earthcarefarm.com. I'm going to circle back a little bit. I noticed when you were blending in the beginning, you were adding in biochar or some type of char material there. And it kind of goes back to, I know this is the topic that a lot of people are wanting to hear about back in 2012, I think, when your site had a major run with persistent herbicides. You guys were the canary in the coal mine of the beginning of that issue with persistent herbicides. And it really helped the industry, what you guys brought to light, what you in particular brought to light for the industry. And can you share about that experience with persistent herbicide and what happened, how you navigated it? I think you did that really well, and how it shaped the way you work today to prevent that, you know, problem with the persistent herbicide.
Sure. Yeah, it does. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but it was now over a decade ago that happened. An unfortunate distinction to have as the person who learned a lot about persistent herbicides and shared all that information, but I think we did learn a lot, and I think other people have benefited. So glad to have had some positive impact because of that. It all started likely for us with some horse manure that had some aminopyrrolid as a component. And there had been some incidences of persistent herbicides in compost in the early 2000s out in California, where I think it had primarily been clopyrrolid and picloram. You know, these are all part of the same family of lovely products that were mostly produced by Dow Chemical back in the day, which now is under new ownership. The one that hit us hard was aminopyrrolid, and it's still sold all over the world as an effective means at applying herbicide to basically rangeland and hay fields, primarily where, you know, these are high quality crops that they're having trouble with, particularly broadleaf plants that are particularly pernicious. And it's really effective herbicide. It takes a very small quantity. And most of these herbicides, the way they were developed, there's a lot of benefit in terms of the overall ecological impact, as far as we know, because unlike some of their predecessors that we've all heard about, 2,4-D, DDT, those have a lot of negative impact for humans, other mammals, amphibians. They can wreak havoc on the environment. These were all designed to not do that. And they're actually quite effective in that regard. They last a long time. That's one of the problems. But they're basically a synthetic plant hormone. And so these target species, which are generally broadleaf plants, will take them up from the soil and go into hypergrowth mode, essentially. And so you get really elongated stems, and then their leaves have this curling tendency, which if you've ever seen the pictures about persistent herbicide damage in common garden crops, it's very distinctive. You've seen these tomato plants with really shriveled fingers, essentially, and it's scary looking once you've seen it and you know what's happening and that it came from your product, kind of sticks with you. But anyway, it takes a very small quantity. So in our case, we did the math at one point. We lost well over 10,000 cubic yards of compost were affected by, we figure, probably a quarter cup of this herbicide. That was all it would require to reach the levels that did the damage that we experienced. And it's because it's effective at less than one part per billion, this particular one. Things like clopyrrolid, sister chemical, are effective at 10 parts per billion. But again, these are tiny, tiny quantities. So it's like a drop in an Olympic-sized swimming pool is all it takes to cause a tomato plant to shrivel up. Unbeknownst to us, we've taken horse manure and bedding forever since our inception. It's one of the components of our product. One or more than one of the local hay farmers was likely using this in their fields and came in. It goes through the animal phase during digestion. So it comes out just as potent as it went in. And then it will survive in manure or compost or the soil for a very long time, over a year. You know, their label says, so they've made some label changes since our incident, but basically you're not allowed to move if you follow the label and everybody involved reads the label at full length. You're not allowed to pick up the manure and move it off farm for 18 months after they've ingested this hay or whatever the other grain feed crop was.
Wow.
And nobody follows labels, of course, or reads labels. And I don't think there was any ill intent by us receiving the material, but we were the recipients of it. And it, of course, didn't show up until actually we received it in 2011 at some point. But then by June of 2012, we got our first call from a garden customer who sent us some pictures, and myself and our general manager for our municipality went out and investigated the garden, and we brought with us the state plant pathology and pesticides head, or a couple of people from that department, and confirmed that it looked like herbicide damage, and that kind of set the ball rolling. And then the next 12 months were a very long time, and a little bit more. But we went full force on response, because within a few days we got a few more complaints, and they were all identical. That
your heart
tomatoes
sank.
Gosh, yeah. I didn't used to have gray hair, but that year,
oh my gosh,
I got a bunch, and it was tricky. Fortunately, we're municipal and have been since 2008. Solid Waste District is our local solid waste authority. It's a municipal organization that is responsible for all the solid waste in our county. They took over our compost operation in 2008. So anyway, we were fresh within their family of facilities when this all happened. But our board was very compassionate and said early on, we're going to make all of our customers good. We're going to figure out what's going on. And so, you know, had we been a private compost facility, we would have probably gone bankrupt within a month or two once we understood what had happened. But instead, we ended up hiring a bunch of people that summer to field the complaints as they came in, to log them all, to go out and visit all and each and every individual one of them. For insurance purposes, we had to document that, yes, indeed, this was herbicide damage. We had to gather the receipts to confirm that not only did they buy their product from us and here are the amount and the time, but here's also all the receipts that they may or may not have saved from their purchases of vegetables, seeds, and transplants. And so we did a whole refund and compensation thing, and it was an ordeal, as you can imagine. Meanwhile, we were having ongoing conversations with Dow and EPA and our local state officials who are very involved in the national level and had lots of great connections and working with a bunch of different labs, trying to figure out, okay, what is the herbicide? We know it's an herbicide. We think we know which family it is, but which herbicide? And it took a while to figure that out because most labs can't find these at these low concentrations. They can't identify them. They're really hard to find in compost, not unlike what we're hearing about PFAS these days.
Yep.
Because they're just such a small concentration that can be damaging. And it takes some really expensive equipment, but more than that, it takes training to actually be able to read through the fuzz. I don't understand all the chemistry and the technology behind the detection, but it is very complicated. And so there was one lab. There were several labs that we started with, and then we lost confidence in a couple of them pretty early on when we would send split samples to multiple labs and gotten very different information. A bunch of the testing was done at Dow because we were working with them rather than suing them. Oh, that had been tried before in California the decade prior to ill effect. And so we worked with them and they were very helpful in trying to determine the cause. So we spent a huge amount of resources and lost close to $1 million in sales. And with all the compensation, lost this huge effort. But as a result, you know, we talked about it very openly. We shared all the information we had. You know, BioCycle wrote a bunch of articles and it became a known thing and kind of launched a bunch of educational materials, articles, workshops, and the like, where, you know, trying to educate other composters. You know, we talked at USCC conferences and worked with Fred Michelle on a bunch of stuff. Craig Coker wrote a bunch of material on it and taught people how to do bioassays and try to protect themselves as composters, because the takeaway was that, like, you could be the best composter in the world, be putting your heart and soul into what it is you do, work hard, make an incredibly beautiful product that people love and cherish, and then they buy it and put their heart and soul into their garden, as gardeners tend to do, and they're so excited and proud and optimistic about their harvest. And then come peak summer, it can all shrivel really quickly. And so we went through a lot of stress in that process, but we learned a lot, and I think we've hopefully had some impact on the rest of the industry to avoid other people having to repeat the same thing.
You definitely have. I really appreciate that. Like, this is speaking for the whole industry. It's really helped the entire industry. So thank you for being so transparent about it. Like, really, really helpful.
Yeah. And that a lot of that credit goes to our boards and our, you know, the fact that we were public. Had we been a private, I think one of the frustrations with all of the herbicides and compost thing is that it's been really hard to get good information about where and when it's happening in the country, because if you're a private composter and you think this is happening to you, you might not be so inclined to go to the press and, you know, collaborate with articles and your Department of Health and, you know, everybody else that we had to work with, because if you're known as the composter that has persistent herbicides, good luck selling next year's compost, and that might be it for your business. So it's been understandably, to whom it has happened, and we are, you know, far from unique, unfortunately. At this point, a lot of other composters in the country have experienced something similar, hopefully not to the same degree, but they tend to be pretty quiet about it. Might reach out to a couple of us and ask for advice, but are less inclined to, you know, fill out a report form with their state or file a complaint with the EPA. I think that's been a frustration and yet understandable also why folks are hesitant to share when it happens to them.
Yep. And now you have a protocol for preventative measures. Would you be willing to share what you're doing? And I noticed a lot of Vermont composters are doing as well.
Yeah. We've got a great group of composters in the state and share a lot of information. And this is one of the good takeaways from our experience. We do a few things. We try to be a little bit selective about the horse manure that's coming in. We stopped taking it altogether for over a year as we were trying to figure out what composting in Vermont meant at that point. Eventually, we started bringing it back. So we're a little bit selective about that and find out where people are, what horse farmers are using for inputs when possible. More importantly, though, we are adding a high carbon wood ash that is very similar to a biochar or an activated carbon. And we are currently incorporating that at about 2% by volume for all the compost that we make, which was one of the outcomes of our mishap over a decade ago. Is we hired Woods End to do a study and found out that this material, such as a biochar, could even at as low a ratio as 0.5% by volume, can be really effective at tying up any of these herbicides in this class of herbicides and not making them available to the plants in question. So we do that. Most composters in Vermont are doing something similar and beyond. And so that has been huge. And then as the compost is wrapping up and finishing maturation, we sample it quarterly and send it out to the University of Montana in Bozeman Agricultural Lab, where they offer persistent herbicide testing. It's not inexpensive, but it's the same lab we've been using now for over a decade and are very confident with their results.
Okay.
So we feel good about that. And then lastly, every small batch we make, roughly 120, 150 cubic yards, we take a sample and put it through our greenhouse for a series of growth trials. So there's a lot written about those. And you can copy that pretty easily if you just Google growth trials, compost, biocycle. There's lots of articles on how to do it, our U.S. Composting Council. So we have batches going through our greenhouse all year round where we use red clover and fava beans, as they are known to be sensitive to these herbicides. So we're always looking for potential damage, and we run a positive control using some spiked compost that we've made with some unknown quantity of cloacrylid in it. So all of those things have us feeling much more relaxed about knowing that everything we're selling is not going to do the kind of damage that we unfortunately inflicted on over 500 of our customers.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad that you stuck with it. That's a tough one to get through. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing all that. That's really, really helpful. Preventative measures and such good information. And so that must have been just a whirlwind of a time period. You're a decade out of it. From what I gathered from you, you have seemed to have found a really great work-life balance or working towards it. What strategies or habits have helped you make that happen?
Yeah, it's important, of course, in any job you have, even if it's a great job like composting. Sometimes when I'm talking with friends outside work and we're comparing work stories or, you know, a long week, I always have to remember that actually I have an awesome job, and any complaint that I might have is very temporary because I work with great people in an incredible industry, making an incredible product, you know, changing a waste into something that makes, you know, grows food and makes people happy is a pretty awesome place to have been for most of my adult life at this point. And so that said, you know, I've been doing it for 22 years now, and it's a long time to be doing anything. Some of those years or decades have been incredibly stressful, some more than others, of course. Yeah, it wears on you. And there are times where you wonder, like, oh, can I just you know, go work at that local coffee shop and not have all this responsibility and not have to deal with all this. And so I found, or I've been fortunate in that I've had a bunch of things that have enabled me to kind of find that work-life balance. And one of them is the fact that we're part of a municipality with a lot of responsibility beyond the organic. So we do recycling and trash and biosolids and on a MRF. And so we are one project of many, one facility of many. And the assurance that even if we have a tough year, if it rains every day in May, and that makes sale difficult because our sales window here in the Northeast is very small when everybody's getting their garden in, that we're still going to be okay. We're still going to have our paycheck and we have great benefits. So that has been helpful. Also, we have paid time off that is always there and that I've gotten better at using over the last many years. And part of that has been enabled by the fact that I have an incredible team that I work with. So there's seven of us who work here full time currently. We used to have a much larger operation where we were hiring seasonal folks and doing a lot of retail and bagging and deliveries and all the things. And a couple of things happened there. We had a new executive director for our municipality came in and questioned kind of our how we used to do things. And she pointed out a lot of great questions and had us rethinking how we did everything. So we went down, we simplified, we basically sell everything wholesale now. We went from 13 employees down to 7, and we can focus on making really good product and take out a lot of the complication. And that has also freed up myself to take time. I still can't take a vacation in May or June perhaps, but I can be gone for 2 weeks at other parts of the year and kind of refresh. And so part of that has been just simplifying our operation, but also the great team that I was mentioning. So we, of the 7 folks, we've had a couple of new additions in the last couple of years, but most of the folks I work with have been here almost a decade. The oldest one has been here almost 3 decades, and they all do an incredible job and know their job and are very competent and can jump from one thing to the next. Almost everybody can jump in a loader and go move a pile if needed. Actually, everybody on staff currently is qualified to operate a bucket loader. Yeah, having that assurance has given me the flexibility to be able to leave and not be worried. So that's been huge. And then I think the last thing is I got a kid who is turning 12 in a couple of weeks. And as he came around, half of his life I've been doing this, and all of his life, half of my career has been the overlap there. And so as he gets older and I recognize that he's going to be moving from home at some point, I've just reprioritized and recognized, coupled with a big injury I had several years back, that there are things that are more important than work, even when your work is doing great things like making compost. So just that recognition and has enabled me to, take a little bit more time outside of work and not spend every weekend in the spring making compost or coming in on a Sunday when nobody else can come in because we desperately need to screen that last 100 yards for the order the next day. So it's a bunch of things together that have enabled that.
That's great. That's wonderful. Yeah. All right. So is there anything else you'd like to share with the composting community? Any resources, advice, or even favorite quote? And you've already shared so much. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Compost Conference is a great one. I think folks who are lucky enough to be able to go to that, I've gone a lot of times now, and I always take away a lot from it, even though I think, oh, this program looks very familiar to the last year's program or the year before. But inevitably, I end up feeling like, oh, that was well worth my time. Attending conferences, either that one nationally or local, I know there's a lot of great state groups and regional groups that just talking to other composters is huge. We have an awesome family of composters in Vermont. And every time I talk to them, I learn stuff and see their sites. Visiting other compost sites is great. I know. I had the one I was thinking of is go bigger in terms of whatever you're, especially if you're new or expanding, like always build bigger than you think you need.
Those sites fill up.
Inevitably, you will need the extra half acre, acre, 5 acres. I could easily use another 5 acres at the moment. Don't have it, but not necessarily go more costly. Like, you can spend a ton of money on technology when it comes to composting, but at the end of the day, making food into soil isn't a very complicated thing, and it'll do it on its own if you're not careful. So we spent over $1 million building this facility now almost a decade and a half ago. Yeah, $1.5 million. But a lot of that was concrete and steel, and you don't need concrete and steel to build a compost facility, or at least to get started. You know, maybe eventually you do. So start small in terms of spending, but go big and utilize every square inch that's available to you, and then buy the neighbor's land when that runs out. I think that's my advice.
Okay, smart advice. I agree with that advice that I'm doing. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate your time. It's so helpful for the industry. Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun.
All right. See ya.
Thank you. All right. See you. Gravity rings around
Saturn and my... Huge thanks again to Dan Goosen, Director of Organics Recycling at Green Mountain Compost at Chittenden Solid Waste District, for taking the time to walk us through Green Mountain Compost and for sharing so openly about his many composty experiences. The story of persistent herbicides is a tough one, but it's also a reminder of how important transparency and community are in this work. Dan's willingness to speak out helped shine a light on a problem that could have stayed hidden a lot longer, and that's made a difference for composters everywhere. If you found this episode thought-provoking, please share it with a fellow compost lover in your life. Big thanks to Galen Brown for being a thoughtful partner in shaping ideas for the show, Yasna Brown for all sorts of tech support, Isadora Biggs for being a great assistant, and to Pete Hamilton for editing these episodes and making my voice sound so smooth. Don't forget, I'll be back every 2 weeks for 10 more episodes this season to continue our chats with amazing guests, including experienced composters from across the U.S. and beyond. And if you want to show off your compost pride, check out the new Composter Podcast merch, now available on the EarthCare Farm website. You can also follow the show on Instagram at the Composter Podcast to stay in the loop between episodes. Thanks again to sponsors AgriLab Technology and Compost Systems of Austria. I'll see you compost lovers in 2 weeks for more compost talk.